Hi, this is the American Psychological Association's Division 15 podcast series on emerging research in educational psychology. My name is Jeff Green. Thanks for joining us. If you've ever spent time with me in person, you might have noticed I'm not particularly coordinated. In fact, in second grade, my school called home to my mom and said, "Mrs. Green, your son seems to have some dexterity issues, so we want to put him in a special dexterity class." And my mom said, "Well, that sounds okay, but when would he take this class?" And they said, "That's why we're calling. The class is offered during his reading instructional time, so he'd have to miss that." And my mother responded with a resounding, "Oh, hell no." She did not like that idea, and thus, here I am today, a professor who reads well, but still occasionally bumps into walls while walking. Clearly, back then, my mom put a high value on reading, and I'd say most of society still does today. But what we mean by reading, and how we should conceptualize and teach it, has been a bit contentious over the last 25 years. That's why today I'm excited to talk to Drs. Courtney Hatton and Panayota Kendeu, who are experts in the science of reading, and who have some great ideas about how educational psychology can expand and enhance how we think about and teach reading. Dr. Courtney Hatton is an assistant professor in the science of reading at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. She earned her PhD in educational psychology from the University of Maryland and her reading specialist degree from Johns Hopkins University. Courtney's research interests are shaped by her experiences as a language arts and social studies teacher at the elementary and middle school levels. Specifically, her work centers equitable and evidence-based instruction that supports students in activating and building their knowledge during reading. She was a 2019 recipient of the Timothy and Cynthia Shanahan Outstanding Dissertation Award and was named a Reading Hall of Fame Emerging Scholars Fellow. Dr. Panayota Kendeu, or Pani, is a distinguished McKnight University professor and Guy Bond Chair in Reading in the Department of Educational Psychology at the University of Minnesota. Pani directs the Reading and Learning Lab and co-directs the College of Education and Human Development Learning Informatics Lab. In her research program, Pani develops theoretical models that explain how students learn during reading and uses those models to design and test innovative AI technologies that transform instruction and improve learning. The significance of her approach is in the development of theoretically oriented work and its translation into school-based practical applications. Today, we're talking about Courtney and Pani's 2024 article published in Educational Psychologist entitled "Expanding the Science of Reading, Contributions from Educational Psychology." This is the introduction to a special issue on the science of reading and educational psychology that they guest edited. Courtney and Pani, welcome to the podcast, and thank you for talking to me about your article and the special issue.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you for having us, Jeff.
So let's start here. What is the science of reading and why is it important?
So the science of reading consists of a large, evolving, and impressive body of evidence about how humans learn to read and how reading should be taught. However, a lot of times the science of reading is defined differently by different stakeholders, so it might mean something different to researchers, to educators, to policymakers. So what we were trying to do with this special issue is really focus on how the science of reading and educational psychology intersect and the body of knowledge that we can then expand with the science of reading.
Great. And so that expansion, I think, is the focus of your article. And your article has a ton in it. And I really encourage our listeners to check it out. We won't be able to cover everything here today, but you do a really nice job talking about existing models of reading, and you group them into a couple different types, and two of the main types are kind of component dominant models of reading and process dominant. And can you just give us like a quick kind of like, here's what those are and here's how they're different?
Sure. It is the case that we have a lot of theories and models in the context of reading comprehension, and they vary in terms of that focus that you mentioned, Jeff. Do they focus on components or do they focus on processes? When we look at component models, those models focus primarily on identifying what are the main dimensions that actually contribute to reading. They do very little to say or to explain how reading is taking place, right? This is all about what contributes mm-hmm. to reading. When we look at process models, they actually focus on the how is reading taking place. Of course, they capitalize on components, but the emphasis remains on the how, the actual cognitive processes that are taking place. And interestingly enough, that division, component models and process models, also translated in literature divisions. So they have been adopted by different communities, and they have been studied in very different ways.
So that's really helpful. Can you give our listeners an example of some of the components and some of the processes that these different kinds of models focus upon?
Sure. If we begin with the component models, like the main model that I think you will find in the literature referenced over and over again is what we call the simple view of reading. Mm-hmm. That identifies what are the absolute minimum components that we need so we can have reading comprehension taking place. And they identify those components as decoding, so our ability to actually decipher code from a written string of letters, right? Understand words and connect words into sentences and understand sentences. And then the other component is the listening comprehension or the language comprehension. So how do we extract meaning from code? This is just an example of two unique components that contribute to reading comprehension. There are many others.
Mm-hmm. And I think that's helpful to give the simple view of reading as an example. I suspect some, but not all of our listeners will be familiar with that. And then in terms of the process models, like what are some processes that people talk about?
So the process models focus primarily on how we connect information, information within the text, and information within the text and our background knowledge to form an understanding, to extract meaning. And those fundamental processes often center around inference making. Mm. That's like a fundamental process that supports reading comprehension.
Got it. Okay. So there's these two different kinds of models, but then you introduce a third kind of model that I think is really important, and those are social cultural models. So what differentiates them from the other kinds of models we've been talking about?
It's interesting because the sociocultural models take a quite different approach to the phenomenon of reading comprehension. They situate it in a sociocultural context, right? And oftentimes they also focus on issues of power, identity, agency, and literacy practices. So they go beyond the components and or the processes by expanding on the actual context in which reading takes place.
Those all sound really important, right? I can imagine how components are important and processes are important and context are important. So, I mean, is it possible to kind of put these all together to better conceptualize what reading is?
Mm-hmm. I mean, exactly what we tried to do in this special issue and in this paper with Courtney. And it is definitely possible, but it's also very complex because the epistemological commitments that have given rise to each one of those types of models are different. Mm. So when we do the theory integration, as you would like to say, mm-hmm. then we have to be mindful that these models have been developed through different epistemological paradigms and commitments. And that has been, I think, primarily our goal here, to show that the science of reading is very diverse in terms of epistemological paradigms and commitments, and as a result, models and theories. But there are ways to bring everything together. There is a way to do theory integration, and we've done that with the proposal of a dynamic systems focus on the phenomenon of reading comprehension.
So I was initially introduced to dynamic systems theories from Avi Kaplan and his work in applying dynamic systems theory to motivation research. Mm. And I just really appreciated the focus on context and on the shifting elements that happen within a specific system. So we attempted to integrate components, processes, and contexts with a dynamic systems theory approach, acknowledging that there are multiple different forms of knowledge. We talk about linguistic, conceptual, strategic, textual, and cultural knowledge. In addition to other forms of knowledge, there are processes and components, and that the context is consistently reshaping the web so that the context and the reader are interacting with each other. But then also recognizing, again, in focusing on knowledge, that knowledge is both a cause and consequence of reading. And in the piece, we have sort of a spider web type of visual analogy to try to portray what we're going for here.
Mm-hmm. And your conceptual integrated framework for reading is really important because it does do that work of integrating the different kinds of models and adding dynamism to it, which I think is really important. And Courtney, you said something that I think is also really, really important, and that's focusing on knowledge. And can you talk to us a little bit about kind of how reading research has dealt with knowledge and thought about knowledge and, you know, kind of how that led to your conceptualization?
So knowledge has been a large part of many different theories and models of reading, but it hasn't always been central the way that we would like it to be or would hope it to be. But in addition to that, when folks typically talk about knowledge, they're usually talking about topic or domain knowledge. So knowledge that relates directly to the knowledge that will be presented in text. So a lot of times what this means is in instruction, a teacher might try to pre-teach information before students are reading a text, or they might try to build students' topic or domain knowledge by using multiple different texts on the same kind of idea or organizing concept. However, what we were trying to do is to also introduce these other types of knowledge that are additionally critical to students' understanding of text. So these include knowledge like strategic knowledge, which is sometimes called procedural knowledge, and that's a goal-directed process that readers engage in to help them decode text and read fluently and determine the meanings of words. Then we also talk about textual knowledge. So this is knowledge of texts in science, in social studies, and in literature, as well as the text structures that are prevalent in those different domains. And then we talk about cultural knowledge, which highlights the everyday knowledge and experiences that students engage in. And this includes families' values and traditions and histories, and also attempting to demonstrate that cultural knowledge cannot be devoid from these other types of knowledge, like conceptual knowledge or topic or domain knowledge, because culture is sort of the water in which the fish is swimming in terms of the content knowledge kind of being a piece of that. So They really can't be separated in that way. And then the other type of knowledge that we discuss, or the last type of knowledge we discuss, is linguistic knowledge. And that includes knowledge about languages. This could include vocabulary knowledge, knowledge of linguistic structures, metalinguistic understanding about knowledge, and also is very prevalent with students who speak multiple languages. So this is really important for students who are multilingual, who speak multiple languages, as well as students who might speak, for example, Black English, and then trying to make sense of the white mainstream English that they're being asked to predominantly read in their literacy courses. So Making sure that we're using students' assets and leveraging their language practices during literacy.
Yeah, you know, that all makes sense to me because my understanding is that knowledge is really important to reading comprehension, right? Like to understand text, it really helps if you have some background knowledge in it. And Courtney, I think you've done some research to suggest that narrow views of knowledge, like what counts as useful knowledge for reading, aren't very helpful. I mean, it seems like people bring their whole selves to reading. And so therefore, whatever types of knowledge they have, strategic, content, culture, otherwise, I mean, shouldn't we be trying to leverage all those things to try to help people learn how to read?
I would argue yes. I think that there, for good reason, there has been primarily a focus on even when assessing students' knowledge, we're typically assessing topic knowledge before students read a text and then seeing what they learned after that. But we're not really thinking about who they are, their experiences, their cultures, their linguistic backgrounds, and supporting them in being able to use all of their different assets as they're reading to help them construct and make meaning from that text. So it's kind of like we've dissected and put topic knowledge at the forefront of what's important, and instead are kind of missing all of the other pieces that make a reader a reader. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I just really like your model because it brings together different kinds of knowledge, all the processes, the components, and then this dynamic piece. And as you said, you represent it as a spider web. So can you expand upon that analogy and help our listeners understand what the spider web represents when it comes to the dynamism and the interactions between readers and reading and culture and background that you talk about in your model?
So the spider web analogy came out of a collaboration with a graduate student at the University of North Carolina. And she is kind of a little bit better at visualizing and actually portraying what we wanted on paper instead of just kind of our jumbled thoughts. So we worked with her and she kind of proposed a number of different analogies, but the one that kind of stuck the most with us was the spider web analogy, where the spider is the reader kind of doing the reading and creating the knowledge. And then they're consistently interacting with all of those other different components. And with that, that means that sometimes if you notice a spider web, there might be some parts of the web that are really nicely tight together and it is really crisp. And then other parts that might be kind of sagging. But thinking about there might be some parts that are stronger and some parts that are weaker. So in that same way with that spider, maybe in a particular reading situation, they could depend mostly on linguistic knowledge or cultural knowledge or certain components or certain processes without depending quite as much on others. So what we're interested in is kind of what is that interaction, that dynamic interaction between all of the different types of knowledge and the processes and components. And then also understanding that the context is going to reshape the web. So one of the things that we said in the paper is that you can sort of imagine a spider that creates a web across a well-traveled path. And that is probably not going to be the best place for this birth of web to take place. The context is probably going to destroy it over time with people kind of going through it, other animals, all sorts of other things. However, if we can see the spider creating a web in a place that is out in the woods, or maybe is not quite as well traveled, it might be a little bit stronger, and being able to kind of really put together all of these different components. So what the purpose of all of that is to say that the context is going to reshape the web, and the web will look different depending on, and the reading will look different depending on where it's taking place. The other thing that I wanted to say here is that there is also a social component of reading that we wanted to make sure that we acknowledge, and which particularly comes from more of the sociocultural aspects and components of reading. So what that means is that a spider can actually work with other spiders to create an even stronger web, in the same way that a student can work with other students or their teacher to strengthen their own reading comprehension, to talk to each other, to build their knowledge together.
Yeah, I really love that analogy. And, you did a good job of doing something that's pretty difficult in an audio medium like a podcast, and that is describe a picture. So kudos to you for that. That's a little tricky. But I think when people go to your article, they'll see that this web graphic that you have really, I think, captures, there's a lot going on. There's a lot of components. There's a lot of processes. There's a lot of different types of knowledge. And as you said, these things get built dynamically over time. In some cases, they're stronger or weaker in certain ways. They might change over time. And what you're describing really does sound like to me exactly what you promised in the special issue, an enhancement or expansion of the science of reading with ideas from educational psychology, spanning things like different types of knowledge and the sociocultural factors, the social factors. And so I really do feel like it's a step forward, and I think it's really useful for researchers to conceptualize reading. I'm also interested in what you think some instructional implications are of the way that you're thinking about the science of reading.
So when we're thinking about instruction, I think it's important to consider that all of these things, all of these different components are kind of happening at the same time in a particular process. So when we're thinking about how to teach that, a lot of times what I'll see in classrooms is that instruction is kind of like, okay, we're going to do phonics for a little bit and that's it. And then we're going to do a particular reading strategy and that's it. And then we're going to move on to this other thing. And instead, what I'd like to see is a more dynamic and fluid integration among all of those different components so that during a phonics lesson, for example, you're also bringing in maybe some vocabulary instruction or meaning-making instruction so that students actually understand the words that they're being asked to learn in a phonics lesson. Or in a comprehension lesson or in a read aloud, one of the things that could be embedded is understanding a little bit more about, for example, multisyllabic words, or kind of using students' understanding of vocabulary and of language to be able to understand the words that they're reading. So it kind of goes both ways in terms of trying to bring this into a more integrated picture rather than having all of those different components taught completely separately. Mm-hmm. And then the other thing that I would say is that this sort of necessitates a shift in how we're thinking about students' knowledge and what students bring to the table and how we're leveraging that knowledge. So we're assuming it, using our framework, that students do have knowledge, that they're not a blank slate that's sort of waiting to be filled, but instead they have knowledge and experiences that they're able to bring with them to a reading experience. And it's up to the teacher to help try to find that starting point that can then sort of provide that stickiness so that students can mm-hmm. stick what they already know to what they're learning in a text.
Mm-hmm. So one of the issues here that we try to really emphasize, as Courtney mentioned, is this idea of complexity and dynamic nature. Mm-hmm. So expanding the science of reading also means expanding the instruction of reading. And that's definitely a shift from where we have been as a discipline and also the practice of teaching reading. And that aligns also with our theoretical commitments, right? So strong focus on the component models, for example, that started early on resulted in this idea that, okay, we have all of those components and we have to identify what those are and then teach each one of those. That limited this idea that reading is complex and it's interactive and it's dynamic. So we need to focus on processes as well to bring those components together. Mm-hmm. And once you focus on processes, I'm going back to the process models, right? Mm-hmm. If we just focus on that and we don't necessarily consider the context in which the reading is taking place, then we're missing out as well. So by bringing all of those together, the sociocultural context, the components and the processes, and integrate them, that changes how we should be viewing and practicing reading instruction. That's mm-hmm. fundamental. So the theoretical integration has a direct implication for the instructional practice of teaching reading. And I hope we were able to communicate that in the paper, but definitely more work needs to happen in translating that theoretical integration into theory-based reading instruction that is comprehensive, but at the same time continues to capitalize and use the assets that the students bring in the classroom.
So I love that, you know, the idea that reading is complex and teaching it requires acknowledging that complexity, but also finding ways to connect students to what they're reading so they can better understand it. I think Courtney used the word kind of sticky, and Pani, you talked about finding the knowledge that students bring with them and using that to guide instruction. I think those are really important things to emphasize. And so I'm so pleased that your framework includes all those aspects. And Pani, you said something that made me think that there's probably a lot more research to be done jumping off the ideas in your model. Like, are there particular directions that you're excited to see explored when it comes to your model or framework and what's coming next?
There are definitely several future directions that we could take. And when I say we, I mean collectively as a community, but also as individual researchers based on our own interests and disciplinary focus that we have. The integration of cognitive and sociocultural approaches in the context of reading, like a more explicit integration of that at the theory level and at the practice level, I think it's definitely needed. We need to understand that deeper so that the teachers can then put that in action and they can teach in that way. So I think the theory integration will then facilitate the actual practice integration.
So another future direction that we were thinking about is also in understanding and embracing methodological plurality. So not only integrating multiple different theories and epistemologies and perspectives, but then also making sure that we are building on really great qualitative research and mixed methods research and using qualitative and mixed methods research to complement the quantitative research that does tend to be favored and used most frequently in both educational psychology research as well as sort of the broader reading field too.
That's wonderful. And, you know, one of the things that we really look for in educational psychologists are papers that expand, enhance the field and point to generative new directions for research and practical implications. And your article absolutely does that. Your framework absolutely does that. There's a lot to explore. There's methodologies that are needed. I think, Pani, as you mentioned, the epistemological commitments are really interesting to explore and see how they integrate in ways that are productive. And what's really exciting for listeners who are interested in these topics is that there's a whole special issue with more contributions. So do you want to give our listeners just kind of like a brief overview of some of the other articles in the special issue and what they could find if they chose to seek those articles out?
So like us, the special issue authors also drew on the theoretical plurality that we have in the area of reading. So they drew on component dominant models, process dominant models, and sociocultural models, as well as additional literature to expand in certain directions. So, for example, Cartwright and Pallian, they introduce a very cool idea by drawing on the cognitive science and the cognitive tradition of reading comprehension, the idea of domain-specific executive functions. In other words, reading-specific executive functions and the role that those could play in the context of reading as a contributor, but also as a potential factor that could be malleable in terms of intervention. It's a really cool idea. I would encourage everyone to read their paper. I think you're going to find it provocative, but also very innovative. For Zani et al., they also propose a quite innovative assessment framework. Nothing like that existed actually in the literature before their contribution. Their framework is equity-oriented, it is justice-based, and it centers readers from historically minoritized communities throughout the assessment process. They do challenge the way we have been thinking and developing assessments in general, and specifically in the context of reading comprehension. Their new framework is quite complex, it's quite comprehensive, but it's also really exciting. And as they also acknowledge, it needs to be put into the test. So I also strongly encourage you to read their paper and see how you can move forward with new assessments of reading comprehension, especially if that's your area of work.
Wonderful. And Courtney, I know there's a couple other articles in the special issue that are also really exciting.
Yes. So Gabriel and Lopez created an asset-based interactive view of reading. And I really love that what they ended up doing, because they kind of combined and integrated the active view of reading by Duke and Cartwright, published in a special issue in RRQ in 2021, I believe, which kind of expands on some of the ideas in the simple view of reading by saying that there are these additional components. So there isn't just decoding and listening comprehension or language comprehension, but kind of highlights what is included in language comprehension, what is included in word recognition or decoding, as well as bridging processes and self-regulation. Then what Gabriel and Lopez did was took the active view of reading and then further integrated it with asset-based pedagogy, which builds on culturally relevant teaching and culturally responsive teaching, and then further integrates it with self-determination theory. So we have a little bit of everything kind of going on, but really highlighting the importance of students' backgrounds and their representations and their languages and cultures, also combined with the importance of motivation. So that's a very cool piece as well. And then Leader and Proctor created a dynamic idiolect framework. So they really focused on multilingual students and thinking about a student as a languager, instead of just kind of being like, you have this language, but they're actually bringing their own unique set of linguistic resources to bear on the reading process. Mm-hmm. And then they're using their language abilities to create sort of this dynamic idiolect, which is comprised of three different parts, linguistic awareness, sense making, and linguistic lamination. So they're really centering the different language practices that students have. And I will say that this is primarily in contrast to the simple view of reading, which they critique as not being sufficient, particularly for multilingual students.
Mm-hmm. And all of that should get everyone excited. But mm-hmm. even if not, I would definitely read Susan Goldman's commentary. So she does an amazing job in evaluating all of this contribution. And she raised really important questions for us all to consider as we move forward in this space. And they come from a space of love, but also a lot of experience of working in classrooms with teachers and students for many, many years, aiming to improve reading comprehension conditions and achievement for all students.
That all sounds amazing. And, you know, congratulations and thank you to both of you for guest editing this special issue. It's truly expanding the science of reading. It's bringing ideas from educational psychology to that literature and I think productively enhancing it. And I just want to say thank you again. It's a wonderful special issue, a wonderful contribution. And often on this podcast, I like to ask the guests to talk a little bit about what the process was like. And often it's about publishing an individual article, but you two were guest editors. And I think there may be people out there who are thinking, like, maybe I'd like to guest edit a special issue. I don't know. Do you have any advice or reflections or tips for people who might be thinking about guest editing a special issue of Educational Psychologist?
I would say have a really fantastic co-guest editor would be my first piece of advice. This was actually my first time editing anything, and I really appreciated Pani's mentorship throughout the process and her ability to kind of help me think through how I wanted to communicate things to authors and what I felt was most important, or maybe how to synthesize or prioritize what reviewers were saying. So I really appreciated having that learning opportunity for me, and Pani was fantastic. Lisa was also fantastic as our official EP editor, kind of supporting us and making sure that we're doing everything that we need to do to make sure that these pieces are of high quality. But I think really what I am trying to say is, like, doing it with someone else and somebody who is amazing and exceptional really made the process a lot easier and better for me and made me feel more confident in the special issue as a whole.
I second that, having a wonderful, amazing co-editor. It was a great collaborative work. I appreciated, you know, the process and working with Courtney and with you all in educational psychologists to actually make this happen. I have to say that teaming up with someone like Courtney, who understands deep the instruction of reading comprehension in addition to the theory of reading comprehension, was key. So we complemented our strengths in terms of pulling something like that together, which was really, really important, because you do need complementary focus and expertise for a topic that is so complex like reading comprehension. So I appreciated the process. I learned a ton through it. I have to say this, in terms of who is doing what work, new methods, new approaches, new terminology, even though we are experts in this space, learning continues, and it's by expanding. So we expanded in the editing process as well, which is, I think, amazing.
One other thing that I think was really interesting, or kind of pushed me also as an editor and a writer, was thinking about not only when we were writing our own piece, not only how we were setting up the special issue, but also trying to make a theoretical contribution ourselves. And that's something that I think EP has been shifting towards in terms of allowing the introductory articles to not just kind of be a summary of what's to come, but instead be a piece in and of itself. So I thought that was really a great opportunity.
And your piece definitely does that. So congratulations again. You know, what I took away from what you said was that, first of all, it's really important to think about the people and the person that you might want to guest edit with. You don't have to guest edit with someone, but I personally like working with other people. So I think that's a really good way to go. And then also the people that you invite for the special issue. As you said, there's such an opportunity to learn. I think the best EP articles really push the field forward. And so, of course, as guest editors, you're going to learn new things because the articles you're editing are asserting new things. And the special issue definitely does that. So again, thank you both so much for your hard work on it. So stepping kind of beyond the special issue, you two are really productive and successful scholars. I mean, Courtney, let's start with you. What are you working on in your research right now that's got you excited?
So many things. I'm actually co-guest editing two additional special issues on the Science of Reading for Reading Research Quarterly. This experience with EP made me realize how much I really love and adore editing and how fruitful that can be as an experience for me. So I'm excited to work with some of the editors over at RRQ to do some additional special issues, one on centering equity in the science of reading and the other on politics and policies within the science of reading. I'm also very committed to research practice partnerships and being in schools and working with teachers and with students. So when I was in Illinois, I had a four-year research practice partnership with some teachers in a school district there. So I've been working on analyzing those data and trying to get those pieces out, in addition to starting a new research practice partnership with a school here in rural North Carolina, which is very, very exciting for me because I love getting to see what's going on in schools and working directly with students and teachers. But the other thing that I try to prioritize is figuring out what the school needs rather than coming in and saying, like, I know everything about reading. I'm just going to teach you that. And instead kind of understanding what the community's needs are and what the teachers' needs and the students' needs are, and then working with them to enhance their instruction. And then finally, talking about knowledge, the last thing that I wanted to say is that I have been working with a really fantastic team of people to critically analyze the representation of knowledge in a popular K curriculum. So with sort of this influx of a focus on knowledge, what has happened is a lot of districts are adopting what are called knowledge building curricula, which I think is a really important and great step forward. There is some research that would demonstrate that this is an appropriate and beneficial step in terms of supporting students' reading and reading comprehension. However, I also think that we need to think about whose knowledge is centered, whose voices are centered, what knowledge is then being put in front of our students, and thinking about what texts kids are reading in order to develop their comprehension abilities. So that's another project that will hopefully be out soon.
Wonderful. Pani, what about you?
There are several exciting projects going on right now and a lot of concern, if I may say. So I'm going to combine the two. The one line of our work focuses on the role of technology in reading comprehension and language comprehension. And we have been developing educational technologies and basic AI technologies that have been integrated in instructional programs for quite a while. However, with the introduction of generative AI and the possibilities that that brings, that project is now moving forward in a very exciting new direction where we can develop fully automated systems that can help us provide supplemental high-quality instruction to all students. Mm. At the same time, we're trying to think very deeply and carefully about how we integrate AI technologies in education. So a lot of our current and future work is shifting in that direction, making sure we're continuing to center our students and our teachers in the process. And we develop systems that respect their autonomy and identity and their use for good. Another line of work that I'm really excited about pertains to the trust in science and scientists. Mm-hmm. Very consequential for our times. Consequential also across history, I'm finding out when we're looking into the literature. And I'm hoping more projects in that area will continue. So lots of exciting new directions. And you may be wondering, well, what does reading have to do with anything? Your mom was right. Reading has to do with everything that we do, and it should definitely be prioritized and is front and center in all of the work that we do.
Way to bring it back around. That was elegantly done. Well done. So I really appreciate the conversation today. I think we're going to wrap it up for now, but I really encourage our listeners to download and read your 2024 article in Educational Psychologists. That one's titled Expanding the Science of Reading, Contributions from Educational Psychology. But there's a whole special issue there on educational psychology and the science of reading with the great articles that you mentioned earlier. And I really hope people download them and take a look because it's exciting, important, and generative work. Finally, to you, our listener, if you enjoy this podcast, please check out our other episodes on your favorite podcast application and consider rating and reviewing us. We always want to get feedback. You can also go to the American Psychological Association Division 15 website, and all of our podcasts are linked in the publication section. So thanks again for your time and for listening.